This is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Kim Beardmore, recorded on March 8th, 2017 at Victoria, BC, interviewed by William Cahoon. Captain Kim Beardmore, do I have permission to record this interview?
Yes, you do.
Okay. Please state your name and rank for the record.
Captain Kim Beardmore, RCN, retired.
And could you spell your last name?
Beardmore.
All right. Where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Fordingbridge, Hampshire, England, in 1946. And I left the UK in 1948. My father was a Canadian naval officer who married an English woman. At the end of the war, and we returned to Canada in 1948. I say we returned. For the first time, my father, obviously, was a Canadian, and I grew up. He remained in the Navy after the war, and or more accurately, he rejoined the Navy after a short hiatus of about 18 months. And we lived across Canada and overseas in the UK. But every 2 years, someplace new.
Yes. That's the naval life, though, as I understand it. All right, why'd you join the Royal Canadian Navy?
Well, I've obviously admired what my father was doing, he obviously had a very large influence on me at that stage of my life. And really from the age of five on, I wanted to be in the Navy. Mm-hmm. And all those years later,
I joined up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Explain what kind of initial training you received upon joining the Navy.
Well, I joined a naval entry program known as the Venture program, mm-hmm. which was designed initially to provide pilots for the Fleet Air Arm, but later became more broadly based and provided officers for all the branches of the Navy. When I joined, it was called the Short Service Officers Plan, and we signed up for a seven-year hitch. And after you had become qualified in whatever your branch was, either as a pilot or as a surface officer, you could apply for a permanent commission if you wanted it, and stay for a full career. Otherwise, you left after the 7 years and you were given a gratuity. A gratuity was, at that stage of the game, I think, as I remember, it was one month's pay for every year that you'd served. So you'd get 7 years or 7 months worth of pay.
But you didn't get a pension like you do today.
No. And now, once you had a permanent commission, so-called, then you stayed with the same terms of services as anybody else. So I stayed till the age of 55.
How was the adjustment for civilian life?
Well, I mean, obviously it was very different than civilian life, even in my family, which had been exposed to... I was exposed to naval jargon early on, and so I knew that a ceiling was a deckhead and a wall was a bulkhead and a floor was a deck and a door was a hatch. So, you know, it wasn't quite the same adjustment for me as it might have been for many of my colleagues.
Yeah, like a farmer out of, like,
exactly.
Alberta.
Or, you know, even worse, somebody who lived in rural Quebec, where not only was it a different language, but it was a complete new set of terminology from the RCN was relatively painless for me. I'll just tell you one little story. Mm-hmm. We got on the train transcontinental train. Some of the lads joined in Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. I got on the train in Ottawa, and remember, this is 1965, and youngsters my age, quite a lot of them wore long hair. Anybody who got on the train with short hair and a coat and tie, the odds are that he was headed to the same place we were, so anybody who got on the train looking like that, we asked them, are you going off to venture? And the answer was invariably yes. So we had an opportunity to meet with and essentially party with our colleagues on the way across the continent.
Oh yeah!
And we were met in Vancouver by this very kindly old chief petty officer, and he sort of herded us onto this naval bus, and we came across in the ferry and drove into the dockyard. Mm-hmm. Where Venture was at that time. We drove onto the Parade Square, and we got off the bus, and we were met by a petty officer second class, and who, it transpired, was a bosun. We didn't know what the hell a bosun was, but nevertheless, it transpired that he was a bosun, and he was also my divisional petty officer, it turned out. We didn't know any of that at the time, but as we got off the bus, he sort of herded us into some semblance of order. And he was a very large man. Mm-hmm. And I've guessed that he was, I don't know, 6'2", 6'3", and a very physically imposing
job.
And had a very loud, good parade ground voice. And he told us his name. His name was Petty Officer Sailor. And he warned us that if any of you smile, you're in really big trouble. And he spied one of my mates that we'd come across the continent with, and he was chewing gum. And he said, "That cadet there! Swallow that gum, you horrible little man!" Which he did, and I knew then and there that my biggest problem in the Navy was going to be keeping a straight face, because I'd been treated like that all my life, so it was normal. And some of the youngsters were somewhat horrified that we were being treated like that, but we very very soon realized that Petty Officer Sailor was actually a very kindly and good divisional petty officer who was always concerned about us and making sure that we did the right things and did them correctly and got looked after properly, and very concerned about our training. Very good man. And but those first few minutes climbing off that bus must have been a real shock for some.
Actually, could you explain what a bosun is to
you? Oh, a bosun, yes. Well, bosun is it's a trade in the RCN, still exists. Mm-hmm. And they are responsible for the upper deck maintenance and for seamanship in the ships. Mm-hmm. So they are the upper deck preservation specialists, so they know about painting and how to prepare surfaces for painting and how to apply the paint and that sort of thing. And I know that sounds like a trivial job, but in a marine environment, it's not. You know, mm-hmm. You're in a steel vessel, which needs a great deal of maintenance, and to prevent it from turning into a rust bucket overnight, needs to be looked after properly. They're also the people who are responsible for hoisting and lowering boats, for anchoring, for towing, for refueling operations, for any of the things that demand a knowledge of seamanship, essentially. Mm-hmm. So they're the seamanship experts in the ship.
What was the first time you served on a DDE/DDH ship?
I joined my first DDH in 1966, in November of 1966, HMCS Annapolis.
Mm-hmm. So what were the accommodations like on the ships?
Well, I my first cabin in HMCS Annapolis was, it was known as the quad cabin. Mm-hmm. And so there were four bunks mm-hmm. in it, and there was two sinks. And as I remember, we had eight lockers, mm-hmm. one full-length locker and a half locker each. Mm-hmm. And there were drawers under the bunk, and the bunks folded into the bulkhead. Mm-hmm. And so a bunk became a settee. And the upper bunk obviously sort of disappeared out of sight. Also, in the Annapolis class, the quad was very crowded because it had a cable trunking mm-hmm. that went from the deck below to the deck above, right up through the center of the cabin. So if you took a, I'm thinking it was probably about 3 feet by 3 feet. So if you took a 9-square-foot hole out of the center of the, and blocked it all off, that's mm-hmm. you could walk all the way around it. And then we also had what were known as I've forgotten what they were called, but anyway, they were desks essentially yeah. that folded out of the bulkhead, and with drawers and what have you below and above. There were two of those in there. There were the lockers. There were four bunks, and I said two sinks, but there's actually only one sink now that I think about it. And so four young men with all their kit, because most of us, in fact, all of us in that cabin, and when I first joined, were bachelors. So everything we owned was in that cabin. Mm-hmm. You know, we might have left our skis or our other sports gear ashore somewhere, but you know, when you deployed, you needed any number of uniforms, from everything from the Arctic to the tropics. And so everything you owned was in that cabin. So it's a pretty crowded place.
And not to mention your dress uniforms.
Oh, yeah.
Dress, absolutely. Like all your dress stuff.
Yeah. And if you had a sword, that was there too. And, yeah. You know, ceremonial sword.
All right. So what were your duties aboard the Annapolis?
Okay. Well, initially I was under training, mm-hmm. and so the program I joined under, the Venture program, required you, when you graduated from Venture, you were promoted to acting sub-lieutenant, and then to be promoted to the rank of sub-lieutenant, mm-hmm. you had to obtain a watchkeeping certificate. Mm-hmm. The minimum time in which you could get a watchkeeping certificate was 6 months at sea. Mm-hmm. When I joined Annapolis in late November of 66, we didn't actually go to sea until the beginning of February of 1966, so there were 2 months. So the minimum I could do was 8 months, obviously, from joining the ship. Anyway, I was blessed with a very good captain, a chap named Dan Mingy, who's retired as a vice admiral. Very, very wonderful, wonderful officer. Sadly now dead, but whose father had been one of the heroes of the Royal Canadian Navy during the Second World War, mm. Rollo Mingy. He was the chap in charge of the Newfoundland station. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I had a very good captain who was very interested in our training. And the following, and we did quite a bit of sea time from January through the end of the summer. And late January through the end of the summer. And one of my colleagues who came through a different system than me was given his watchkeeping certificate. So I asked, and I, being a a cocky young fellow and having a certain amount of confidence, I thought I should have got my watchkeeping ticket at the same time he did, and perhaps even before he did. But regardless, he got it. But he, because he had been a regular officer training plan officer, mm-hmm. he was already a lieutenant, and I was still an acting sub-lieutenant.
So he was your superior officer.
And so he was my superior. But anyway, so I went to see the executive officer, and I said, you know, I don't wish to sound like a braggart, but I do feel that my watchkeeping abilities are on a par with this other officer, and I would like to know when I might expect to get my watchkeeping certificate. So he said, well, I don't know, Kim, but let me go and talk to the captain. So he went and talked to the captain, and the captain, obviously they had a chat, and then about an hour later, mm-hmm. I was sent for by the executive officer, and he said, well, I'm sorry, Kim, but, you know, the captain doesn't feel as though an acting sub-lieutenant should have a watchkeeping ticket, and he's waiting for you to be promoted to sub-lieutenant, and then he will award you your watchkeeping certificate. And I said, well, there's a problem here, sir, and that is that under my terms of service, I can't be promoted to sub-lieutenant unless I have a watchkeeping certificate.
Oh, God.
He said, oh, I didn't know that. He said, wait here. And he went up and he went and spoke to the captain. And about 5 minutes later, he came down and said, come with me. And I went up and I was presented my watchkeeping certificate. I was given my watchkeeping certificate. And subsequently, over the next 3 years in that ship, I was the deck officer. I was an air control officer, mm-hmm. Whose responsibility was to do tactical control and approach control for the helicopter that we carried and other aircraft assigned to our ship for control purposes. Mm-hmm. And I was also the navigation officer. Mm-hmm. Took a nav course in 1968. And subsequently navigated the ship.
Is there only one navigating officer on a ship, or is there multiple?
No, there is only one. The navigator is called the navigating officer. So you take a navigation officer's course, and then subsequently serve as the navigator. So I was the navigator. Now, other officers who stand watches on the bridge watches are responsible for fixing the ship's position, in other words, navigation, while they're on watch. Mm-hmm. But the navigator is responsible for planning passages, so mm-hmm. planning from home port to wherever you're going. Mm-hmm. He's also responsible for, in my day, we didn't have as many electronic navigation devices as presently exist. There was no GPS, there was no satellite navigation. There were some electronic navigation systems, but they were subject to significant errors for various reasons, mm-hmm. atmospherics, etc. And we still use celestial navigation. Mm-hmm. So the navigating officer was responsible for taking morning stars and evening stars to fix the ship's position. So, you know, just like out of the 18th century, you know, there you were using a hand bone, which is a sextant. Yeah.
All right. So just a quick question about what was the purpose of DDEs or DDHs?
Okay. Well, the DDE, DDH design, they all started as DDEs.
Yeah.
And the DDE design was an outgrowth of all the lessons learned in the Second World War. Mm-hmm. It had to be big enough so that it could withstand the weather in the North Atlantic. Mm-hmm. It had to be fast enough to be able to catch fast submarines. It also had to be fast enough to stay with fast-moving convoys. Mm-hmm. It also had to be well enough armed to deal with those submarines. They were specifically anti-submarine ships, although they had some general purpose capability. Their surface warfare sensors and weapons were not particularly effective. But then they weren't designed to go up, you know, toe-to-toe with a big gunship or something like that. They were designed to, if a submarine popped to the surface, to give that submarine a very bad time. They were also designed to engage aircraft. So their principal purpose was anti-submarine warfare. And the DDEs were Canadian designed, Canadian built. They were built specifically for our conditions, so very cold weather, very nasty sea conditions. And they were wonderful sea boats. They really were. They were just superb. Very maneuverable. Twin screw, twin rudder. The rudders would actually go to, you could put them over to 45 degrees of helm. So from straight fore and aft, they would rotate a full 45 degrees in either direction. And they were extremely maneuverable. And they outperformed virtually any ship of similar size anywhere in the world. And that design was then improved upon. Now they had anti-submarine weapons galore. They had Mortar Mark 10 and Mark 43 torpedoes, which were pretty good anti-submarine torpedoes for their day, although they were originally designed as airdrop torpedoes, but we modified them to be fired from old depth charge throwers. And then later on we got Mark 32 tubes, which were triple tubes that would carry Mark 44 and Mark 46 torpedoes. And lightweight torpedoes. We also had a pretty good sonar sweep for that day and age. And then to improve their ability to counter fast-moving submarines, they were fitted with helicopters. And we were the first Navy to operate big helicopters off small ships. And that was a very successful marriage. Sadly, we're still flying the same helicopter.
Oh, so when was the... It was the Sea King, correct?
Yeah, the Sea King, yes. And the Sea King came with... We got our... I forget exactly when, but it was around 1964 when we got our first Sea Kings. And they were flown by a squadron called VX-10, and they were the experimental squadron, so they were... Until we worked out all the kinks of operating helicopters from small ships, and then HS-50, which was... the operational helicopter squadron got its first aircraft, I believe, in the late 1965 or early 1966. And then Annapolis, where I was serving at the time, had the first operational detachment in a DDH. And then a number of the Saint-Laurent class were converted to DDH. Annapolis and Nipigon were actually built as DDHs.
Yeah, specifically as a different... So were most of the DDE DDHs based on the Saint-Laurent class, or...?
They were all based on the Saint-Laurent class. They were all... For the Restigouche class and the Mackenzie class were just improvements on those.
Yeah, just making...
And then as was the Annapolis class. And so they were the Americans would call them Flight 1, 2, and 3. The Brits would call them something else. But anyway, the point is they were all improved Saint-Laurent class,
yeah,
of one form or another. And there was the internal layout, the power plant, many of the sensors were identical across
the board,
across the fleet.
Yeah.
All the initial Saint-Laurent class, all of them were converted to DDHs. Mm-hmm. The Restigouche class became the improved Restigouche class with different sensors and weapon systems. Mm-hmm. They were fitted with ASROC, mm-hmm, which is a rocket-propelled Mark 46 torpedo. And they also had a different gun. Mm-hmm. They had the British 3-inch 70, whereas mm-hmm the DDHs all had the American 3-inch 50. Mm-hmm. 3-inch 50 was originally designed during World War II as the answer to the kamikazes. Mm-hmm. It was a radar-directed, radar-controlled weapon with a pretty high rate of fire, and was not a bad gun for any aircraft. The 3-inch 70 was originally designed as secondary armament for a cruiser. The Tiger and Lion, which were Tiger, Lion, and Blake, which were three cruisers that the Brits built in the late 50s. Mm-hmm. And they had as their secondary armament, their anti-aircraft armament, they had 3-inch 50s, or 3-inch 70s, excuse me. And we bought those to be fitted into our Restigouche and Mackenzie class. Interesting. My father was the guy who was sent to the UK to buy those guns.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He was an ordnance officer.
When did your father retire, by the way?
In 1965.
Just after you joined?
Just after I joined. In fact, he retired. I joined in September. It's funny how things go around. I'll tell you another story in a minute, but I joined in September of 1965. He retired in October of 1965. Mm-hmm. And I lie. He retired in October of 1966. Mm-hmm. So we overlapped by a year.
Okay.
Now, March on, 36 years, my son joined the Navy, the RCN, in July of 2001, and I retired from the Navy in September of 2001. So, yeah. Continuous service. Interesting little overlap.
Your grandkids going to serve in the Navy?
Well, I could happen. I don't know.
All right. So, and then after Annapolis, what was your ship? What was your next DD/DDH ship?
Well, After Annapolis, I was sent to stand by HMCS Preserver when she was in build. And, of course, a junior officer, navigation trained, air control, very attractive to the fleet, but what are they going to do with you while they're...
Well, you're sitting on
that. Well, you're sitting on the jetty watching the ship being built. You know, mm-hmm, there's no useful work for that. So I was sent back to Annapolis. and I did a Mediterranean deployment. Mm-hmm. And then I went back to Preserver, and we commissioned Preserver, and I spent a year in Preserver, just over a year. And then I went on the Long Operations Course. Mm-hmm. And the Long Operations Course was 13 months long. Mm-hmm. For we knuckle-draggers who hadn't been to university, we were sent on a pre-academic course where they taught us physics and higher levels of mathematics. Because in those days, if you went on the operations course, not only were you responsible for the operational employment of the equipment, you were also responsible for the maintenance of the equipment. We didn't have combat systems engineers in those days. So if you went on the weapons course, you were responsible for the weapons, maintenance of the weapons, as well as the operational use of those weapons. Mm-hmm. If you went on the operations course, you were You know, so radars, radios, electronic warfare gear, yeah, all came under the operations officer for not only employment, but for maintenance. So they gave us a pretty extensive 3-month pre-academic course, and then we did 10 months of intensive training to teach us how to be operations officers and look after this equipment and also to operate it, to employ it operationally effectively. And you became the principal tactical advisor to the commanding officer.
Yeah.
And part of that was you also took a deep draft navigation course as part and parcel. It was all embedded in the course.
Mm-hmm.
So you took an advanced navigation course at that time as well. I graduated from that in June of 1972.
Mm-hmm.
Came out here to the West Coast and joined HMCS Mackenzie,
yeah,
which answers your question, what was my next DDE?
Yeah.
And I joined as the operations officer.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after I joined, a chap named Norm May, who sadly was killed in a car accident some years later, but that's another story. But Norm May joined as a navigator. And on our, I think about our second trip with him as the navigator, he fell down a hatch and broke his shoulder. And the system couldn't provide a navigator in a hurry. So my captain said to me, "Beardmore, you've been navigation trained. You're now my navigator as well as my operations officer." So I had a double job, which actually turned out to be really good. I really enjoyed it because I love navigation.
Yeah, lots of work.
Lots of work, and it was, well, you know, it was fun. I'll tell you another funny little story. My captain, I'd only just taken over as the navigator, and our very next trip was to be, we were going from Esquimalt to, I think, Powell River.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to go to Powell River for, oh, I can't remember why, it doesn't matter. Anyway, we were going to go to Powell River. And the route that my captain wanted to take was out of Esquimalt Harbor and then around Trial Island up Harrell Strait and then up into, through Active Pass to get into the Straits of Georgia to go up to Powell River. So when I brought the plan to my captain for approval, he said, "Yes, Kim, I like the plan. What speed did you plan to go through Active Pass at?" And I said, "Well, 12 knots, sir." And he said, "Oh, no, that's much too slow. Let's go through at 22 knots. And I said, "Well, sir, remember, I haven't navigated for over a year now, and, you know, I'd just like to get my skills back up to the appropriate level before we do something as challenging as that. I highly recommend that we do it at 12 knots." He said, no, Kim, we're going to do it at 22. I said, "Well, sir, you know, you need to understand that you, of course, are the captain, and we'll do whatever you order, but you need to understand that although the ship may be doing 22 knots through Active Pass, I'll only be navigating at 12 knots." When it came to actually doing it, we went through at 16, so it was...
The middle ground.
The middle ground, that's right.
How fast, like, comparatively to, like, ship speed, is, like, 22 knots the top?
Okay, no. It's not. Mackenzie's top speed was about 28 knots. But most people who go... water skiing, mm-hmm, behind a speedboat, they will be doing somewhere around 20 knots.
Mm-hmm.
So 22 knots is pretty damn fast.
Trying to navigate through a pass.
Exactly.
Hopefully you didn't hit anything.
Yeah.
And then after Mackenzie, you transferred to Terra Nova.
I did. I was in Terra Nova for, as memory serves, I think I was only there for about 5 or 6 months. Terra Nova was going, I believe she was going into refit.
Mm-hmm.
And even if she hadn't been going into refit, Hans Hendel had been promised Terra Nova as the ops officer.
Yeah.
And I had already done 2.5 years as an operations officer, so I was being moved off to do something else. And so I moved on, and Hans came in behind me. And I don't remember whether Terra Nova went into refit then or not, but anyway, what...
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. And I went off to Ottawa to become a career manager.
Mm-hmm. All right. How long were you a career manager for?
Just 2 years.
Just 2 years.
Yeah.
And then you transferred. Yeah. So then you transferred back to it. What ship did you transfer to?
Well, I left. When I left the career management job, I went to Fleet School Halifax, mm-hmm. where I was the long course officer. So I was responsible now.
You taught the people. Well,
I taught, and also I was responsible for the course content,
mm-hmm.
and course scheduling, and planning the final C phase for the course.
Okay.
So throughout that period, I spent a number of months at sea, but with the course as an assessor and designing the exercise that was used to assess them. And then in February of 1979, I was appointed as executive officer of HMCS Assiniboine.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my next full-time ship.
How does being an executive officer compare to like being an operations officer or navigating officer?
Well, the executive officer has much broader responsibilities than the head of department. The head of department, as the operations officer, you're responsible for the training of your men. You're responsible for the efficient operation of the weapons and sensors, mm-hmm. while you're on watch. You're also responsible for, in my day, you were responsible for the maintenance. And then just shortly before I stopped being an operations officer, the system produced something called a combat systems engineer, who is now responsible for the maintenance aspects of the job. But the responsibilities of the executive officer, who is also the second in command of the ship, are much broader than those of a head of department.
Mm-hmm.
The head of department is focused on the people and the equipment within his department. The executive officer is focused on the ship-wide concerns.
And the captain
is on top of the heap.
Yeah.
And the way I used to describe it when I was the captain, I would tell my XO, executive officer, that you run the ship, I drive it. So the executive officer was responsible for making sure that the ship was clean,
mm-hmm.
well-maintained, that the ship's company were well-administered,
mm-hmm.
that they were appropriately clothed and fed and paid and all those things. He wasn't responsible for doing it, but he oversaw it.
Yeah.
So, you know, if the supply department was letting the side down and wasn't feeding the troops properly, which, you know, from time to time,
it happens,
you know, with the best will in the world, people make mistakes. Well, the executive officer is responsible for ensuring that those mistakes are rectified,
mm-hmm.
And so first and foremost, he's responsible really for the people, all the entire ship's company. Secondly, he's responsible for maintaining the hotel. So the mess decks, the wash places, the heads, the galley, the messes, by messes I mean the eating spaces and that sort of thing. Making sure that those are well maintained, they're clean, and people are looked after appropriately. And then he also has to remain current in a tactical sense, because when the captain needs to put his head down, you become the go-to guy. And you're also responsible for the organization of the ship, so that you have trained teams to do all the things that you need to do. You know, if you need to send away a boarding party, is there an organized boarding party? He's responsible for what's called the watch and quarter bill. And the watch and quarter bill details what it is that every sailor on board, every man on board, and now men and women on board, get. He knows exactly which teams he belongs to, where he's supposed to go in certain certain various circumstances, entering and leaving harbor. Has he got a special sea duty station? When he goes to, when we go to defense stations or the two watch system, what's his job? When we go to action stations, what's your job? All of that is detailed in the watch and station bill, and the executive officer is responsible for ensuring that that all works. And you have teams, you know, you have demolition team, you have a boarding team, you have boats crews, you have the diving team, you have the forecastle party, the quarterdeck party, the top part ship, you have the boats parties, you have et cetera, et cetera. So, so the general organization and morale is the executive officer's.
Sick as a job.
Yeah.
You mentioned in your preliminary interview form the salvage of the Danish flagged MV partnership.
The captain of the ship was a chap named Mike Duncan. The captain of my ship was a guy named Mike Duncan, who's again sadly dead. But he, we were on a fisheries patrol off just south of Newfoundland. And we heard a distress call from this ship called the Partnership. And it's a Danish flagged cargo ship. And they had a deck cargo of some sort of steel structure. And that structure had been welded to the deck. And they would cut the welds and take it off when they got to their destination. But one of the welds, some of the welds had broken, and the structure had fallen over to the side and caused the ship to take on a very significant list. And that had, because it had such a significant list and stayed there, what's called the day tank. In merchant ships, what happens is, in many merchant ships, not all, but in this merchant ship, the day tank takes, you take fuel from the main fuel tanks and you pump it up to the day tank, and then the day tank provides the fuel to the engines. Because it was had a big list, the pumps that supplied the day tank lost suction. And so they couldn't get the fuel out of the big tanks into the
engine,
into the day tank, so the engines quit. And now you're in a very bad storm as well. So they called up, they declared a mayday, a which is, you know, an SOS. And so we went to the rescue. And what we did is we when we got on scene, we the storm had quieted down a bit by then, and we managed to get a boat over to them, and then we took their crew off, all but their captain, who wouldn't leave. And then we put some of our bosuns and a couple of engineers on their ship, and so that we could pass a tow. Mm-hmm. And we actually towed them from south of Newfoundland into Chedabucto Bay, mm-hmm. which is a bay near Canso in Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. And once we got them into calm water, then we passed the tow to a commercial tug who
towed them. And,
Well, for that, the Crown sued the shipping company for salvage, and
the Crown being the British Crown, or
no, the Crown being the Canada,
the
Queen
Crown
of Canada,
the
Queen of Canada. So the Canadian government sued the shipping company for salvage rights, and we got a very large settlement. I don't know what the captain got, but it was a lot more than I got. I got about $1,800, as I remember, which is a hell of a lot of money in those days.
Yeah.
This was 1979. And it took about a year for it to find its way through the courts, but we got the money. And that was the first time that, since the Second World War, that Canadian Navy had, or the people in the Canadian Navy had, wound up with the money. Mm-hmm. What had happened during the Second World War is all such circumstances, mm-hmm. You're still entitled to salvage under international maritime law, but all the money went into a fund.
Yeah.
And that fund is called, and exists today, the RCNBF, the Royal Canadian Naval Benevolent Fund.
Yeah.
And it's used for good works for naval dependents. So it provides bursaries, the occasional scholarship. Veterans who've come on hard times can make application to the Benevolent Fund for monies and that sort of thing. And that all came from salvage during the Second World War. Mm-hmm. After the Second World War, that piece of legislation that enabled that, I'm not sure what happened to it, but anyway, for some reason it didn't apply to us. Mm-hmm. And we got money directly, mm-hmm. and which was kind of nice. And it wasn't taxable because the government deemed it a windfall. Mm-hmm. Then my captain unfortunately got quite ill in April and went ashore. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that was left in the ship's program at that stage of the game before refit was pre-refit trials. So I took over command and completed the trials and then took her into refit. And after that, I was relieved in command by a chap named George Braithwaite and remained as his executive officer through until June of 1981.
Why did the ship go into refit?
Well, it was a scheduled refit. Mm. So it was essentially deep maintenance. Mm-hmm. And in those days we did zero manned refits, so ship went up to Montreal, mm-hmm. and we were taken over by the shipper, Vickers shipbuilding, mm-hmm. and they completed a long list of work that was required to bring the ship sort of back up to full operational level. And we completed the refit. It would have been early September, I guess. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
subsequently did workups and joined the NATO squadron and did all kinds of stuff. And then I left her in June of 1981. And then I was on leave until beginning of August when I started my staff course in Toronto. Yeah.
So up to this point, how serious was the submarine threat, the Soviet submarine threat to Canada and other its NATO allies?
Well, it was obviously a very serious threat. I've forgotten how many submarines the Soviets had at that time, but it was a big number.
Yeah.
And their submarines were becoming increasingly capable.
Yeah.
And they constituted a very particular threat to the NATO alliance.
Mm-hmm.
What we were concerned about was that they could close the Atlantic sea lanes to us. So all the trade that crossed the Atlantic could be put under threat. Many of the NATO war plans called for carrier task groups and army reinforcements to cross the Atlantic. And unless the submarine threat was dealt with, we would be denied the ability to put those carrier task forces where they needed to be and denied the ability to reinforce our troops in Europe.
So what was the capability of the DDE/DDHs to combat these ships as they, like, so submarines, they gained nuclear submarines at a point? And
well, the DDEs and DDHs were very good anti-submarine ships in their day.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, their anti-submarine capabilities, in fact, all their operational capabilities, eroded over time.
Yeah.
And by the late 70s, early 80s, we were in a position where the threat was actually more capable than we were.
Mm-hmm.
Our sonars were some of the newer sonars were actually not too bad, but the ones that were fitted in the DDEs and DDHs were certainly, they didn't perform as well as we would have liked. Now, we had variable depth sonar, and that gave us one advantage, but let's put it this way. Soviet submarines were becoming faster.
Yeah.
They were becoming quieter,
mm-hmm.
and becoming more difficult to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that we stood a very good chance of dealing with the threat effectively, really up until about somewhere in the late 70s.
Yeah, and then
Our ability to deal with that threat eroded, so that by the mid 80s we were not in a very good position to.
And that's why the Delex refits went into place.
Well, no, the Delex refits didn't actually improve the operational capability all that much.
Okay.
What it did was extend the life of the hulls, extend the life of the engineering systems. The 280s were in existence then, and they were pretty effective ships.
Yeah.
They had pretty good sonars, but there's only four of them.
Yeah.
And the rest of our fleet was becoming increasingly obsolescent.
Yeah.
I was interviewed by I took HMCS Ottawa up the lakes. And that was our 75th anniversary cruise. Yeah. The Navy's 75th anniversary was in 1985. I took the ship up the lakes, and I was interviewed by a very nice woman from the CBC. I'd left Toronto and I was on my way to Hamilton, so it wasn't very long. Sort of, it was a day cruise.
Yeah.
And uh, I taken her with me, and I was being interviewed for the CBC, and I said, "Okay, well, I'm going to tell you something, but I don't want this to hear on the I don't want this to be heard on the CBC because, I mean, to be honest, this would not do me or my career any good at all." And because she'd asked me one question, the Falklands War had taken place in 1982.
Yeah.
And she asked me what would happen to HMCS Ottawa if somebody fired an Exocet at Ottawa. And I said, well, not for attribution, but the truth of the matter is we'd blow up and sink.
Yeah. Not the.
We had no ability to combat the sea skimming missile.
Yeah.
In those days, we didn't even fit, which we do today, 50 caliber machine guns at various places on the ship. We didn't even have one of those. I had the twin 3-inch 50 up forward, which I used to call, when it came to sea skimming missiles, I said, okay, that's the morale builder. As long as that's going bang, they know we're still afloat. You know, that's. But any ability of that system to actually shoot down a sea-skimming missile was pretty remote. You'd have to be pretty damn lucky to for it to do what you needed it to do.
So why did the Canadian government just order a whole new set of ships for?
Why didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, you might well ask. Canada generally has not spent what it needed to on defense. And navies are capital intensive organizations. Anything a navy wants in the way of equipment is going to cost lots and lots of money. And governments, unless they're being threatened by an outside entity, don't like to spend money on defense. They would much rather spend it on social programs, on developing industrial strategies, or I mean, you name it. All the things that governments do cost money. Defense costs a great deal of money.
Yeah.
And it prevents them from doing, if they have to spend a lot on defense, it prevents them from doing all those other things that most of the people who control the purse strings think are much more worthwhile than defense. So, unfortunately, we have been the defense generally has been seriously underfunded by Canada really since. Certainly since the first Trudeau years.
Yeah.
And you could probably, arguably, since before that. So, really, since the beginning of the, really, since the early 60s, Canadian defense programs have been underfunded. Occasionally, we get really good things. And in naval terms, those things are, we got the Saint Laurent class, which are cutting edge in their day. Unfortunately, they weren't replaced in time or upgraded in time. And then we got the 280s, cutting edge, not enough of them. And then we got the CPS, probably not a bad number. We probably could have done with five or six more, but you know, we got 12, and they're wonderful ships. And the most recent update to the frigates addressed their operational capability as well as their life extension. So they've got better radars, they've got updated weapon systems, etc. So we learned that lesson. But now we're going into the shipbuilding program, the, you know, the National Shipbuilding Program. Or shipbuilding strategy, as it's called. And it, there's some question about how many hulls we're going to get in the, for this new surface combatant. Well, we need, what we really need is 16. probably 18 or 20 would be better. But with the money that's available, we're probably only going to get, well, I don't know, you pick a number, but it won't be 16.
Probably 10.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, governments don't like to spend money on defense. Yeah.
So to talk about unification for a second, how did you feel when unification was announced?
I thought it was a bad idea from the get-go. I thought there was... now, remember, I was a fairly junior officer at the time.
Yeah, of course.
And so the other... Now, I have to say that over the years, I haven't changed my opinion. So my perspective might have changed somewhat, but my opinion regarding unification has not changed. It was not a good idea. There was lots of scope for doing things, doing things better. There are lots of things that we could have and subsequently did more effectively and more efficiently. Going to the same pay system for all three services.
Yeah.
That's a good thing. Aligning the rank structure. Yeah, I could live with that, and I can see the reasons for doing it, but really, in certainly in naval terms, we don't need as many non-commissioned ranks as we have. Mm-hmm. In the old days, by the old days I mean World War II, we had ordinary seamen, able seamen, leading seamen, petty officer, and chief petty officer. We had five ranks. And after integration, we had ordinary seamen, able seamen, leading seamen, master seamen, petty officer second class, petty officer first class, chief petty officer second class, chief petty officer first class. So now we got eight ranks. Well, we got three ranks that we really don't know what the heck to do with. Because the supervision levels and skill levels don't require that many divisions. We're stuck with it, and it's probably that's probably okay. That's one of the things we can live with. But the theory that you could train an infantryman to be a bosun and subsequently go and do aircraft maintenance was a nonsense, an absolute nonsense. And putting us all in the same uniform destroyed any sense of identity. One of the reasons that armed forces are cohesive and disciplined and have tremendous capability is because they have identity. They identify with the group. They identify with the regiment or the squadron or the service.
Or the ship.
Or the ship. And you can say, well, what the clothes they wear doesn't change that, but it does. In the other thing that they did that I thought was a bad idea, although it didn't come about with integration, it came about subsequently, it was unifying the Department of National Defense with Canadian Forces headquarters. So you had civilians and uniformed personnel integrated into a single organization. Well, the responsibility in the old days of the Department of National Defense was they were responsible for the development of policy in which the uniforms would participate. They were responsible for ensuring that money was spent as planned and directed by the politicians. And they were responsible for sort of third line stuff. In other words, they were responsible for maintenance and acquisition and research and development at a very much higher level. And then the day-to-day operations of the uniform folks didn't have any civilian involvement at all. Really, except in the form of policy direction. So this integration put civilians in places where they shouldn't have been, and with powers they shouldn't have had, and so forth. Anyway, I am not a fan of integration. I am not a fan of unification. I thought unification was a very bad idea. There was lots of scope for sensible integration.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now we'll move one more question here. Did you ever come into close proximity of Soviet ships during your career?
Yeah, numerous times. The first time I saw a Soviet ship was in 1968. Mm-hmm. And Bonaventure was at the beginning of an exercise called Silver Tower, which was a NATO exercise, and I've forgotten what the objectives of the exercise was, and that's not important, but we'd been in Dublin. Mm-hmm. The Canadian task group had been in Dublin. Bonaventure had gone to Londonderry, which is in Northern Ireland, and the destroyers had gone to Dublin. And we had rendezvoused after leaving Dublin and Londonderry. We rendezvoused with a carrier late one evening, and as I remember, we were six destroyers and the carrier. Mm-hmm. And we were steaming north because we were going to rendezvous with another NATO fleet somewhere off Scotland. I had the morning watch, and just as the sun rose, the ops room reported a radar contact to me that was closing from astern at 33 knots.
Yeah.
And so we tracked it, and then it came into sight. And it steamed right through the formation, and it was a Kotlin class destroyer, and which won't mean anything to you, but it was a pretty fancy destroyer for the day. And that was the first guy I saw. I mean, they had and he steamed right through our formation.
Oh my god!
Yeah. Right by the carrier and. So that was the first Soviet ship I saw. Subsequently, I saw them. I saw their intelligence gathering ships all over the place. Their AGIs, they're called.
Yeah.
In the Baltic, I have. In the Baltic, I've encountered East German and Polish fast patrol boats. Mm-hmm. And I played chicken with those guys. I was with the NATO squadron at the time, and these guys were maneuvering in and out of our formation at high speed and at late at night and shining lights on our bridge. And
that must have caused some stir.
Oh, I tell you, it was a fun night. And one time I didn't actually see. I didn't actually see the submarine, but I detected. I detected again with the NATO fleet off the Azores. I detected a submarine, and managed to identify it through its sound signature.
Mm-hmm.
And we were an American and I worked together to hold contact on that submarine for about 4 hours off and on, and then we were told by the Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic to thank you very much, go away, which meant that one of our submarines had been ordered to go into trail on it, so in other words, mark it.
Yeah.
And so it stayed with the submarine, so that was kind of an exciting afternoon.
Yeah. So then eventually you took a command of HMCS Ottawa.
Well, in fact, those last couple of stories, I was in command of Ottawa at the time. Yeah. I took command of Ottawa in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
I had been CO of the base in St. John's prior to that, and I took over in beginning of July 1984, mm-hmm. and I remained with Ottawa until the end of July 86.
Yep. So what sort of operations were you involved in while on HMCS Ottawa?
I did two NATO deployments.
Yeah.
I did a number of NATO exercises. Mm-hmm. I did what we used to call combat exes, which was the combat control officers course would come to sea in ships and do their final testing. Their final examination would be a practical exam at sea, and that would be we'd run an exercise, and I was one of the ships in the exercise doing that assessment. Did a Great Lakes trip, mm-hmm. which was to show off Canada's Navy to Canadians.
To everyday Canadians.
Yeah, exactly.
Never been to Nova Scotia or Esquimalt.
Yeah. And that was good fun.
Mm-hmm.
Spent a lot of time in the Eastern Atlantic, mm-hmm. in the Baltic, and as far north as North Cape and as far south as Venezuela. So
well, as a captain of a ship, what when you went for a port visit, like what is sort of things did your sailors do in their free time?
Well, generally we visited NATO ports,
yeah.
and we were offered lots of hospitality,
yeah.
By the locals. There'd be sometimes dances were organized. There were often cocktail parties for the officers and parties ashore for the troops, so that the local, you'd visit a naval base and the men's mess ashore would entertain your sailors.
Mm-hmm.
If we were traveling with the NATO fleet, quite often we have entertainment between ships,
mm-hmm.
and you'd organize tours for sailors to see some of the historic sites, yeah. locally, and that was often done by the local naval base. They'd organize bus tours to see, if you were in Copenhagen, you'd go off to see the castle at Elsinore, or various other things.
Yeah. Was most of the free time for the sailors organized, or were they ever?
Oh no, there was lots of free time for everybody, yes. to do
whatever,
do whatever you wanted to do.
Golf,
yeah, golf is a very popular, yes. yeah, pastime. Some folks like to see historic sites. Some people like to play golf. Some people like to go hiking in the countryside. Some people like to go downtown and drink their face off.
Yeah. Did you ever have any problems with discipline in port visits, or like?
Well, I never had any problems,
yeah.
but which isn't to say I didn't have the occasional incident.
Yeah.
And if sailors misbehaved, then the tools were available for commanding officers to deal with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, Canadian sailors generally were very professional, mm-hmm. and took a professional and mature attitude towards their behavior ashore.
And has that stayed through from when you started till today, or?
Well, yes, I would say.
Yeah.
Definitely. One of the things that has happened over time is the standard of education of sailors has improved.
Mm-hmm.
There were lots of sailors in my day, early days, that had grade 8.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are lots of sailors with degrees.
Yeah.
But having said that, the Navy always provided the training that was necessary for them to do the job that they needed to do, and invariably the training had excellent results.
Yeah. So then, the Cold War. So after Ottawa, what did you do after Ottawa?
After I left HMCS Ottawa, yeah. I took command of the combat division at Fleet School.
Yeah.
Where I was responsible for all operational, mm-hmm. Operational type training for the fleet. Mostly I was responsible for individual training.
Yeah.
So individual training is when, a sailor gets sent on a course. Mm-hmm. That's individual training. Right. When a team comes up to do something, that's called collective training.
Yeah.
And, or was in my day, I have no idea what it's called today. Yeah. Anyway, so my organization in the combat division did mostly individual training.
Mm.
And we would run courses at various levels for people who were sent to us. But we also did some team training, collective training. Mm. That was done in the simulator.
Mm-hmm.
Which, so we had ops from simulators, so people, we could run tactical scenarios for people.
Yeah.
And after, I spent 2 years there, and then I went to the UK on exchange to teach at the Royal Naval Staff College at Greenwich.
Yeah, and then the Cold War. The Berlin Wall came down and the Cold War ended.
Yeah.
How did that change the focus of the Canadian Navy and DDEs and DDHs in general?
Well, what had become increasingly apparent was that the threat, whatever that threat might be, whether it was the Soviet Union or, increasingly China was building up its military. Funny things were happening in the Middle East, and when I say funny things, I mean clearly
not
things weren't playing out the way the West might like it to have played out. It became increasingly apparent that our ships were inadequate to the task. They didn't have enough general purpose capability.
Yeah.
Submarines, when the wall came down, the monolithic threat posed by the Soviet Union was clearly no longer that which it had been. There were still lots of submarines around. ASW was still important. But every tin pot little country around the world had fast patrol boats with missiles, or shore batteries with missiles, or jet aircraft that could launch missiles, or so it became increasingly important for ships to have the ability to counter an air threat, and potentially even a small surface threat.
Yeah.
And the CPFs that started to come online just about the time that the wall came down.
Yeah.
The first CPF I think was commissioned in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong by a year either side, but it was the early 90s. The first ones were commissioned, and they had a much better general purpose capability.
Yeah.
They still had a very good anti-submarine capability, but they were much better able to defend themselves in the increasingly threatening circumstances in which our ships found themselves.
Yeah.
You'll remember in 1991, the first Gulf War,
we
had to use some of the systems that had been bought for the CPFs and fit them in Terra Nova, fit them in Athabasca, and fit them in Protector when they went off to the Gulf War. Specifically, I'm thinking of anti-aircraft systems like the Phalanx. So, I think the biggest difference from Cold War to non-Cold War is the threat was no longer as specific It was much more broadly based, and potentially the potential for Canadians to get into a bun fight mm-hmm. was actually increased rather than decreased.
Mm-hmm. All right. So after you, after being at the Royal Naval College in Greenwich, you were assigned to National Defense Headquarters as a policymaker.
Yeah. Well, policymaker.
Policy.
Yeah, I was in the policy group.
Yeah.
Initially working in continental policy, where I was responsible for working with the politicians to close Argentia. Mm-hmm. And I actually worked for John Crosby for a short while. He was the member of parliament for that part of Newfoundland. Mm-hmm. And Argentia had been an American base, and they were closing it. Mm-hmm. And the implications of that base closure were people were going to be put out of work, and they didn't know what to do with the base, and so on and so forth. So I was assigned to do some work with that. Also, while in continental policy, I worked to develop. I didn't actually do the developing, but I was working on the technical aspects of a couple of orders in council, which mm-hmm. permitted visits by nuclear-propelled and potentially nuclear-armed visits of Allied vessels.
Right.
And you may or may not remember, but the Mulroney government had brought in an environmental assessment mm-hmm. procedure under, I forget what the act was called, but anyway, it was now law that any activity of the Canadian government had to be subject to an environmental assessment.
Yeah.
Well, it was deemed that, and I think this was, I forget who raised the issue, but it would have been one of the sort of left-wing environmental groups or left-wing political groups that thought that this was an opportunity to shut down visits by American ships, British ships, French ships, that were nuclear-propelled or potentially nuclear-armed. And the consequences of us doing that environmental assessment might have been that those visits would no longer be allowed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was deemed by my boss, the deputy minister, that this would be a very bad idea. We'd already had the example of New Zealand, which had prevented the visits of those ships, and the Americans had punished them economically very significantly.
Yeah.
And we did not wish, when I say we in the department did not wish to see Canada subjected to those same punishments. Yeah. So we looked for a workaround. Well, clearly the legislation wasn't going to get changed, so what we did was we asked the government to pass orders in council.
Mm-hmm.
And do you understand what orders in council are?
Yeah, they're, as far as I remember, they are appointments by the Canadian government, the cabinets, just...
That's correct. Yeah. What they are is essentially, it's ruled by direct cabinet directive.
Yeah.
And so orders in council were passed, which permitted mm-hmm. the visits of nuclear-propelled mm-hmm. and potentially nuclear-armed, because nobody would confirm or deny whether they were
nukes on the ship.
Nukes on the ship, okay. So potentially nuclear-armed vessels to specified ports.
Mm-hmm.
And those specified ports were... and are, to this day, I believe, Victoria,
mm-hmm.
Esquimalt,
yeah.
Halifax,
mm-hmm.
and St. John's, and St. John's was a refuge port.
Yeah.
So if a nuclear submarine got in trouble, it could come into St. John's.
Yeah.
It wasn't deemed necessary to do it for other ports because the vast majority of visits took place to Halifax and Esquimalt, yeah. Victoria. And just about the time that we got those through, we didn't need to expand them because the Americans and the Brits took all their nuclear weapons out of their surface fleet.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you could send ships into Vancouver or into Montreal or wherever you wanted. Anyway, so that's the issue that I worked with Continental Policy, and then I was promoted to captain and immediately transferred to the Policy Planning Group.
Yeah.
And the Policy Planning Group, we were the folks that wrote the 1994 white paper.
Yeah.
And then I managed to escape to Halifax as the Chief of Staff Plans and Operations for Maritime Command,
mm-hmm.
which was the forerunner of the Navy.
Yeah.
Still had its headquarters in Halifax at that time, although subsequently it moved back to Ottawa, which is where it belonged all along.
Yeah. And then you became Captain of the Protector.
Yes, yeah. And then I went to England for 4 years as the naval advisor at CDLS London,
mm-hmm.
Canadian Defence Liaison Staff London, and then retired.
Yeah, why did you retire, by the way?
Timed out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I could not have served any longer.
Yeah,
in those days, it was, you had to retire at 55.
Yeah. Now it's 65, or?
No, it's 60, and it's 35 years of service or age 60, whichever comes first. Having said that, if you're only sort of 55 when you've got 35 years service, sometimes they'll let you serve for another 5 years, but it depends on whether they have employment for you and so on.
Yeah.
But your guaranteed employment stops at 35 years of service or age 60, whichever comes first.
And then, all right. Okay. All right, I think that's everything. This concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Captain Kim Beardmore on March 8th, 2017. All right, and I'm just going to try to close that. All right, sorry. Thank you for letting me interview you, and I provide you with the form.
Yes.
Correct? Yeah, the interview release form, and we've both signed it.
Yes.
And you had an addendum for the signing it that you wanted to make sure that if you can still write experiences about your naval experiences.
Indeed. Yeah. I happily surrender all copyright to the interview done today.
Yeah. That's no problem. That should not be a problem. All right.
Yeah. And